Welcome to the teleclass, Infectious Disease in Space, Reality, Risks, and Remedies. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my friend and colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I would like to say how pleased we are that you have joined us today. This is a larger crowd than normal. You folk are joining us from the U.S. and Canada and Brazil and England and all the way from South Africa. Welcome all. This year we have scheduled about 50 teleclasses with wonderfully articulate faculty from all over the world and on a wide variety of infection control topics. However, I will now admit to a serious prejudice in our choice of topics. All of them are directed at and apply only to people who reside on this planet. Today, however, we will make some reparations as we go offshore, way, way offshore. It is an honor to introduce our faculty for this teleclass, Dr. Nicole Buckley. Dr. Buckley joined the Canadian Space Agency in January 2002 as program scientist for Space Life Sciences, and recently she was appointed director of Life and Physical Sciences. I am tremendously impressed with her, and I am honored that she's able to make this time for us, so I won't take up any more of her time with my introduction. To present Infectious Disease in Space, Reality, Risks, and Remedies from the Canadian Space Agency, I give you Dr. Nicole Buckley. Nicole.
Yeah, well, thank you, Paul, and I'd also like to thank both you and Dr. Sattar for contacting the Canadian Space Agency and giving us this opportunity to share some of what is known about infectious disease in space. So, if I understand correctly, I'm going to beep now and we'll go to the next slide, please. Now, the outline of the talk that I'm going to do is I'm just going to review a few basic definitions just to make sure that we're all on the same page as I proceed with the rest of the talk. And then I decided to split this into what are the concerns about infectious disease in space, what are the things that we're monitoring, why are we worried, but what has been our experience? Because by this time, we've had over 600 astronauts in space, and they've been there for a few days, up to over a year. So we're starting to actually know something about what happens to their health. So I'd like to discuss some of that, and then what are we doing about what has happened, what is based on the reality of what has happened with these astronauts, and what should we be doing? The next slide, I basically have just defined human diseases, which are basically an interference or disruption of some aspect of normal function, and they can be caused by infectious agents, genetic defects, environmental factors, or any combination of the above. But today we're going to be looking at mainly infectious agents, which on the next slide, you can see can be either bacteria, viruses, fungi, protozoa, or helminths. Now, I'm probably going to be saying some things that a lot of your audience already know, and I hope you'll excuse me, but I decided that for this kind of talk that maybe I'd be best if I just keep a fairly general information level out, coming out. Now, bacteria are going to be your single-cell organisms, and it's interesting that they outnumber all of humanity and all the other organisms in the world, and they're actually my particular favorite for an area of study. And they're susceptible to antibiotics. And we think of strep throat or staph infections. Those are caused by bacteria. Now, viruses are inert particles that are comprised basically of genetic material encased in a protein shell with more or less a couple of other modifications in some cases. Now, in order for them to replicate, they have to enter a host cell and basically co-opt that cell's reproductive machinery. So when we think of viruses, we can think of the influenza virus or the HIV virus. Now, also we can have fungi. Now, fungi are somewhat similar to bacteria in causing disease. However, they're quite different in that they have a defined nucleus so that they're closer in some ways to us. They tend to be much bigger. And they cause things like yeast infection or aspergillus can be in the air and in some cases can cause a respiratory infection. And trichophyton is when thinking of the Olympics on right now, can cause athlete's foot. Now, for protozoa, there are not too many that cause disease, but the ones that do, do it very well, unfortunately. So the protozoa tend to be small single-cell like animals. And you can think of Plasmodium, which causes malaria, or trypanosomes that cause African sleeping sickness. Now, the helminths are indicated by a lovely pink picture, and that's Atania psyllium. And those are basically worms. And that would include something like the pork or beef tapeworm. Now, in the next slide, I indicate that basically infectious diseases can be split into two groups. You have the communicable type, and these are the ones that can spread from one host to another. And that can be like red measles, or even something like strep throat, which can be contracted through the inhalation of droplets. Now, there are also other infectious diseases that, again, can be attributed to a certain agent, but they're not really communicable in the sense that they're not necessarily spread. They might originate from our so-called normal flora. And one of the examples I always think of is thrush, where if somebody is on antibiotics for a long period of time and their normal flora in the mouth is cleared out, sometimes they Candida albicans, a yeast, can sort of take over and result in a condition called thrush. Another example would be some case where you actually ingest the toxin, but it stems from an infectious agent. One example of that would be botulinum toxin, which is produced by Clostridium botulinum. And that actually comes from eating improperly canned, improperly canned foods. And in this case, although the bacteria have been present, it's actually in 90% of cases, it'll be the ingestion of the toxin that'll result in fatality. Now, finally, you can have infections that are caused by agents that are found in the environment. And tetanus is a good example. Now, tetanus is found in the soil. It's commonly found in horses and cattle. And when we eat raw vegetables, sometimes we even find it in the human alimentary tract, and maybe something like up to 25% of humans. Now, that's not a problem. However, if you step on that nail or if you have a deep skin trauma where you're actually introducing the tetanus organism deep into where the blood is, then you can end up with tetanus. Now, in the next slide, I basically have reviewed quickly here Koch's postulates. Now, Koch was a German microbiologist who really set things going for the germ theory and the whole idea of infectious disease by formulating these four postulates that really capture a large part of the microbiology and the whole infectious disease theory. Now, first of all, to have a disease, you have to have a causal agent, and it's got to be there consistently if you want to say that organism causes the disease. Secondly, you have to be able to get that agent out, or else how are you going to know that it's causing the disease if you can't identify it? So we usually like to try to isolate it from the diseased host. And we try to purify it to be able to attribute disease qualities specifically to that organism. Now, once we've isolated it to ensure that it is truly the causal agent, we usually like to try and test it out on a susceptible host and show that, yes, indeed, that organism, if we introduce it into a susceptible host, will cause the disease. And then after that, we have to be able to re-isolate that agent from our now sick experimental host and show that it's the same organism from the beginning. So now, Koch's postulates for their time were perfect and really capturing the idea of infectious disease. But now we're commonly faced with a little bit of a different scenario that makes things a little more complicated. Now, I've been trying to think of different metaphors to try and describe this, and this is the one that I'm currently using. Now, an organism that really works well with Koch's postulates would be something like, imagine you have a town, a good town, and you have a pyromaniac there. If you have a fire, then chances are really, really good that that pyromaniac has set that fire and destroyed all the buildings in town. Now, if you move that pyromaniac into another town, that everyone's pretty nice people, if you get a fire, you're pretty sure it's that pyromaniac again. Because you can tell, the buildings are burning down, he likes to set fires. Well, that's something that really obeys well Koch's postulates. But now, sometimes we're experiencing, and this is with opportunistic infections I can give some other examples in a minute, but now we see sometimes that maybe we don't have a pyromaniac. Maybe we have just a misunderstood young man. And perhaps there's his best friend is saying, why don't you go start that fire? So in this case, it's actually the friend who's maybe encouraging the starting the fire, maybe providing the lighter fluid or something. Maybe that's actually the causal agent. But what we see next to that burning building is actually sort of a secondary. This is the guy, the poor dumb schmuck who ended up setting that fire. So something like this would be a case of something like, say, an infection with HIV, where you had the immune suppression, but for a while there, it wasn't clear that it was actually the virus that was causing the problem, because people were usually dying of either cancer or very severe secondary infectious disease. So this is a case where Cox postulate is not so easily identified. Now, another time when it cannot work so well is when we can't necessarily grow the isolate outside of the disease, or we don't have a susceptible host. So there can be some challenges to identifying truly what is the underlying infectious agent in a particular disease syndrome. And so I'm now going on to the next slide, where I'm basically reviewing the human bacterial load. Because, again, we carry with us an awful lot of bacteria. And going back to my town analogy, it's a good thing. The way I tend to look at it is that we have a town full of happy, happy town folk, and that on our bacteria in the skin, we're usually looking at 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 4 bacteria on a square centimeter. But it depends on what part of the skin you're looking at. But in the mouth, we're looking at around 10 to the 10 bacteria can be found. In the gut, you're looking at around 10 to the 14. And in stool samples, you're looking at between 10 to the 11 and 10 to the 12 bacteria per gram of stool. Now, each day, we shed around 10 to the 10 skin scales, and those can harbor up to 4 times 10 to the 7 bacteria. Now, we're going to come back to when this can be pretty important in a moment. Now, when we're looking at our human bacterial load, and going back to my town analogy, we have healthy, normal, good population. When we're in good health, it's good to have these bacteria around. And I kind of see it as sometimes you'll have the cowboy with the black hat ride into town. But if you have a strong, normal flora, they'll say, mm-mm, there's no room for you here. And that person's not going to, or that cowboy's going to have to just leave town, and he won't be able to cause any trouble. But sometimes, let's say you treat antibiotics or you have immunosuppression, well, that might result in maybe half the town's people aren't really there. So when that cowboy runs in with his black hat, there's not an awful lot of opposition. So he can take over, and he can start burning buildings or doing what he wants. And that can be, and so that we can actually have a destabilized population that allows for a transient organism that normally would not be found there to come in. Now, and this would be a case where, for example, say in a burn case, you have Pseudomonas aeruginosa can now infect where it normally would not be found on skin. Now, sometimes you can have a resident population where, and this is, again, going back to my town analogy, let's say you've got a gang of youths that are a little bit rough, but usually they're pretty good. And usually the rest of the town sort of says, no, stop this, put down the lighter, come on, you know, maybe they'll just have a little bit of a ruckus on a Friday night, but they don't really do any damage. Well, maybe their parents go out of town for the weekend, and they start doing some really bad stuff. Well, this could be something like opportunistic infections, where under normal circumstances, pretty benign bacteria or organisms, but under certain circumstances, they can get quite nasty and lead to disease. So this is basically my introduction, just getting us into thinking about infectious disease. And this applies to both Earth and space. Now, in the next slide, I've started trying to introduce, now, what are the risks in space for infectious disease? Well, first of all, when you think about it, manned space travel, it basically provides conditions that are perfectly ripe for infectious disease. We tend to have crowded living conditions, and if you've ever seen any pictures of a Soyuz and imagine three cosmonauts in there, you realize just how crowded it can be. You tend to have a closed-loop environment, so air is recycled. And on space station right now, they actually are bringing up water. But in some cases, you will have water that, well, we're trying to work through, certainly to go to Mars, we're probably going to have to find a way to recycle water. You also have, in space, it's really hard to keep really clean. You have a reduced capability for personal hygiene. And this is getting back to the shedding of the skin scales. I once talked to an astronaut, and she was telling me how when she would take her shirt off when she was on the space station, it would be like this little snowstorm, because normally when we shed our skin cells, they just, you know, fall to the ground. We don't really notice them. But in space, they weren't necessarily actually coming off the body, so when she'd actually go to take off a shirt, all these skin scales would suddenly be liberated simultaneously, and it would look like this little blizzard around her. So your capacity for personal hygiene is greatly reduced. And also, it's a little trickier to keep things clean when you have limited water supply, you're in a closed contained environment, you don't have necessary access to autoclaves and these kinds of things, and you also have to be kind of careful about what you're using to clean up since you are in a closed system, so you can't just open the windows and air out the place afterwards. There's also a problem is that if somebody does get sick, it's pretty difficult to isolate them if you're in a very small environment. Often we have jet pilots and we'll have various types of astronauts, but you might not have a surgeon or infectious disease specialist on board. So you sometimes, and also you don't have access to a complete hospital pharmacy. So while they do have antibiotics on board, there is still some limitations to what treatment they can provide. And finally, there's a lot of indication that we have an alteration in the immune response, and there's some reduction. So taking all these together, you think that this would be a pretty good situation to find a lot of infectious disease. And certainly, the longer you're going to be up there, the longer you're exposed to these conditions, then certainly the greater should be the risk. Now, and also, when you think of going to Mars, we're not just looking at infectious disease in humans, but we also have to think about other things, such as maybe plants that they might bring along for oxygen and also maybe even for food. Now, in one mission, in STS-63, they had planned an experiment to look at plant growth in microgravity. So they had seeds that they had that had undergone a fairly rigorous surface sterilization on Earth. But surprisingly, when they brought back the seedlings that had grown in the microgravity environment, after just 8 days, half of them showed visible signs of fungal contamination. Now, the ground-based or grown controls had no sign of this. So it's not just humans who can be susceptible to the conditions in a space vessel. Now, on the next slide, we're looking at some of the other risks, which can be contamination that comes from around you. This can be in the air, the water, the surfaces. You also want to make sure you don't have any of the any rotting food around. And also, when you look at, now this isn't really infectious disease, but I just thought this was quite interesting, but you also want to make sure you don't get mold or you don't get anything growing on some of the critical material, such as electronics or EVA suits. And the EVA suits, EVA is the fancy way of saying the spacewalk. It stands for extra vehicular activity. Since working with the space agency, I've learned to be very acronym conscious. Now, on Mir, it was a much more, on Space Station Mir, it was a much more humid environment. And they actually did have some significant problems with mold growing on computers and on various pieces of hardware and resulting in equipment failure on occasion. Now, on the next slide, I indicate, again, what are some of the sources of contamination? Well, as I said, we have a pretty wide population of organisms that we carry just on our own person. Also, they do try to keep things clean, but just in the environment on Earth, you can't completely sterilize a spaceship or a shuttle. So it's possible to have things that are not just from the humans, but also from the Earth environment. If they're taken up plants or animals, then those can provide, again, another, a whole other group of flora. And the food that they bring with them could also contain things. So nothing is completely sterile. And then there's always a thought that, aha, maybe there's going to be something that comes from outer space. Now, to date, there is no convincing evidence that I see that we have found anything from outer space. There have been some certainly intriguing possibilities, but I think the jury is still out on that. But one of the things you have to watch was something that they observed with Apollo 12. When Apollo 12 lunar module landed on the moon, it landed near Surveyor 3, which was a probe that had landed around 2.5 years earlier. Now, so the astronauts went out, examined this probe, and they decided to bring back an external camera that was located on the outside of this probe. Well, lo and behold, they found a live bacterial specimen on the camera. And it ended up being Streptococcus mitis, which is a fairly normal flora that's found in the gut, and especially in the oral cavity. So now, they might have been really surprised to find out that the men on the moon have the same bacteria as us, but then they realized that because of the precautions they had taken, in picking up this external camera and loading it to bring back, chances are that that bacteria had actually survived on the lunar surface for around 2.5 years. So it would have survived around 31 months in the vacuum of space, or relative vacuum of space. It would have survived the solar and cosmic radiation and some pretty impressive temperature surges. And Strepsomyces isn't necessarily a spore former. So certainly the space environment is not completely lethal to bacteria. It might stop them from growing. So this is something of a concern when you think about all the satellites that are being launched and things that might land elsewhere. You don't want to contaminate the environment you're going to, because especially if you're looking for new life, you want to make sure you're finding the new life and not some hitchhiker that you've brought along with you. Now, on the next slide, I'm trying to describe here just some of the two main conditions of the space environment that can add to the risk. The one is microgravity. We don't have gravity as we do on Earth. And when you think about it, all life on Earth is evolved with gravity. So when you go into space, you suddenly eliminate this gravity. It's really quite amazing that we do so well up there. Now, we have evidence that bacteria do not behave the same way that they do in microgravity as they do on Earth. We've seen differences in growth rate often increases. Their metabolism seems to shift. And we've even seen some differences in virulence and certain pathogenic qualities. But one of the problems has been is that there's been limited access, and there's been very little consistency in the type of experiments. So sometimes you'll have someone report that increased virulence here, but someone might do the experiment a slightly different way and find that there's less virulence. Now, one thing that has quite caused a stir is that we have seen differences in antibiotic susceptibility. Now, I found one study where they actually found that there seemed to be a bit of a difference in the ability of the antibiotic to bind to bacteria when they're in a microgravity environment. So there's that to be concerned about. And again, I've also seen other papers where they say, no, there's not really that much of a difference in the susceptibility. But I found one paper where they found that, I think it was E. coli in space, it was much more resistant to antibiotics. But then when they brought it back down to Earth, the antibiotic susceptibility was, again, restored and comparable to what you see in space. So again, and also the microgravity environment means that not only do bacteria not behave, or organisms might not behave the same way they do on Earth, but again, we can have some other challenges with hygiene and control. Now, in this picture, you actually see bathing in space, which likely came from Skylab, which was the last shower in space. On ISS and on the space shuttle, there are no showers. They actually take sponge baths, and it was basically because using a shower ended up being quite a chore, because they ended up having to vacuum all the soap and water that had escaped from the shower module. Now, another aspect on the next slide on the microgravity environment, the fact that just droplets in air, when we think about all the things that you can risk to inhale on Earth, because of gravity, a lot of droplets, and you know, when you cough, it will rest in the air for a few seconds, but then it'll go down to the ground. But if you have a small particle in microgravity, there's nothing to bring it down. So those things are going to linger in the air. And we do have HEPA filters that have been installed on the ISS, so that now the fact that they could last for 17 minutes means that they usually don't, because they'll usually after some time get picked up by the filters. However, you will find particles will rest longer in air than on the ground. And another thing that I found in doing some reading in preparation for this was that sometimes the astronauts, they have to worry about their eyes, because things that normally would fall down don't. So they have to be kind of careful to make sure that they don't get stuff into their eyes. And they've actually made special eye cleaning goggles for use in space. Now, on the next slide, the other pretty unique aspect to the space environment is the radiation environment. Now, we know that radiation can have pretty severe effects on the immune system, and we also know that it can cause mutations, both in the infectious agent, and also there are, of course, some concerns that they could cause mutations in anybody who's going to be staying up there for long periods of time, or germ cells. Now, the radiation in space is not the same as the radiation we encounter here on Earth, because we have an atmosphere that blocks out much of the radiation. So in Earth, we get in space, we have a lot of protons and heavy ions that result from solar flares. There are also cosmic rays that seem to come from probably stars in the Milky Way. And we have particles that get trapped in our own magnetosphere that if you're in, an ISS, that you're going to be not that far removed from that area. And there are certain areas that are particularly, because of the polarity of the magnetic field around the Earth, there are certain areas that are particularly enriched in trapped particles. And certainly on ISS, they avoid any spacewalks when they're passing through those particular areas. So the radiation environment is also another is a big consideration. Now, for risks, we know that along with, say, something like radiation, that there are a lot of conditions that can exist in space that can actually impact the immune system. Now, that would include exposure to environmental chemicals. There's an awful lot of machinery and unusual things and special objects and all kinds of bizarre machines that are up in space that we don't see here. And it's pretty well, it's a small environment that's wall-to-wall with all kinds of life support mechanisms. And so you actually could be exposed to quite a lot of different environmental chemicals. We know also that, of course, as I mentioned, the radiation. We also know that space can be very, very exciting, but can also be a bit of a stressful environment. And I guess as psychologists refer to it as an ICE environment, which I believe stands for isolated, confined, and extreme. Again, if you feel really stressed out and you want to take a walk, you don't really have many places to go. In addition, you have the isolation. Now, and the nutrition is very interesting. A great deal of time is spent making sure that astronauts find food that they enjoy in space because it's been shown that, or anecdotally, astronauts have reported that their tastes tend to change in the microgravity environment. Well, a recent report came out indicating that astronauts, they just don't eat right when they're up there. And so that it was actually found that they often are have limitations in their nutrition because they're just not eating well enough. And we know that poor nutrition can lead to some effects on the immune system. So I hope by now that I've sort of indicated just various reasons why we are concerned about what could happen in the space environment. Now, in this next slide, we're going to start looking at, okay, now we've described all these risks, how serious are these to the crew health? Well, in order to address that, the best thing to do is to look at what have we seen to date. Okay, now, on the next slide, I've just indicated some of the reported incidents that occurred with Apollo missions. Now, during Apollo 7, for example, there were a lot of upper respiratory symptoms that were, it started with one of the astronauts, and then it spread to his two shipmates, because again, they couldn't really isolate him in the Apollo ship. Now, but the thing is, an upper respiratory tract infection, it's really not pleasant in microgravity. On Earth, our sinuses will drain eventually. In space, they don't. So this can lead to a lot of accumulation of fluid in your sinuses and, I guess, some significant pain. So upper respiratory symptoms are not to be taken lightly in the space environment. Now, in Apollo 9, it's one of the few launches that was delayed for 3 days because of a viral infection. Now, so, and this was, again, an upper respiratory tract infection, so they just basically waited until everyone felt better, and then they proceeded with the launch. Now, Apollo 13 is one case, but again, there was an infectious disease occurring, but it's a very unique situation. Now, you'll recall, especially if you saw the movie, that after the command module lost power, that the astronauts retreated to the lunar module to use as a lifeboat to basically return to Earth. Now, inside that lunar module, it was very, very cold, and they also had very limited water. So they basically rationed themselves to about 6 ounces of water per person per day. So they were starting to get severely dehydrated, and they were there for around 87 hours. Now, one of the astronauts became quite feverish and lethargic, and by the time he was landed, he could be treated, and he ended up being treated for a urinary tract infection that was caused by Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Now, on the next slide, On the next slide, again, the Apollo 8 was kind of interesting because in Apollo 8, all the crew experienced a bit of a viral gastroenteritis before flight, and they were all treated. They all seemed to be fine, so then they launched. Well, in space, one of the astronauts had a recurrence. And from all accounts, a gastroenteritis in space is very not pleasant. And you have to understand that even with this urinary tract infection, one of the problems is that on all the Apollo missions, there were no toilets. So basically, you had some problem just from wearing this urine collection device. So you can imagine gastroenteritis would be quite unpleasant. So now overall, if we sort of look at during Apollo missions, there were sort of minor infections of skins, eyes, a bit of some of the respiratory tract, there's some stomatitis. In Skylab, which was the American space station that stayed up for 172 days in the late 70s, there were about 8 reports, again, of minor upper respiratory tract. So it's all been fairly benign to some extent, what has been seen. Oh, and another thing that the astronauts have to worry about are basically skin infections. Now, skin infections can be related to the fact that it's very hard to move when you're in a spacesuit. They actually end up getting a lot of rashes, and particularly the gloves, because it's basically like you're working in this inflated balloon, and you're trying to move, and that so they actually lose a lot of skin off their fingers, and they've reported a lot of hematomas underneath their nails. So these kinds of conditions can leave you ripe to get a little bit of skin infection. And also, astronauts are there up there also being guinea pigs for us scientists, and they often wear biosensors. And just wearing biosensors for long periods of time can also result in skin irritation. So this is basically what some reports from the Apollo mission. But now, if we look at now this is based on some NASA information, what do they say is the risk of infectious disease? So this is as far as frequency goes, based on what has been reported. Now, and this is in the next slide. Well, you can see that anorexia, spatial motion sickness, and fatigue top the list of risks to astronaut health and performance. But dermatitis, which would, again, probably be related to some of the conditions of basically wearing biosensors, of doing spacewalks in clumsy suits, wearing these horrible gloves, that can result in some of the dermatitis. You can have the upper respiratory tract infections, urinary tract infections, not so pleasant. And there also are some risks of diarrhea, but these tend to be a little further down the list. Now, as far as a concern for the diarrhea and this kind of thing, the Russians have looked a great deal. They tend to look not so much at for an individual agent, but often they tend to be very, very keen on the whole concept of a sound microbial ecology. And so the Russians have looked at, in one report, they looked at up to 20 cosmonauts before and after 11 missions, and the missions went up to 96 days. Now, they looked at their gut flora, and they found that Enterobacteriaceae and Clostridia all increased, which is usually not such a good sign. And they found, decreases in the lactobacilli, which is usually what we want to keep fairly high. Now, the changes increased with the mission duration. However, during this, they still did not find anyone actually getting ill. But again, these are, I wouldn't even say red flags. We're at probably the step of a yellow traffic light here. Just something to be cautious, observing. So now on the next slide. Oops, I went the wrong way again. Okay, so the next slide, we know that the immune system is depressed. We've seen changes in the immune system both before, during, and post-flight. Now, we don't have a lot of data concerning this because it's very, very difficult to get enough samples. But it appears that the antibody response appears to be largely unaffected in space. Cell-mediated immunity does appear to be decreased. Now, whether it's due to the microgravity environment, the stress, the isolation, it could be due to many things. But we have seen reductions in T lymphocyte mitogen stimulation. When we see alterations in the different subsets that are present in the peripheral blood, and we also see altered cytokine production. Now, the cytokines are the soluble proteins that are released by cells and that allow cells to communicate, and ultimately cytokines choreograph the immune response. So the next slide. Next slide is really interesting. Now, varicella zoster virus is the causal virus for chickenpox. It's usually your primary infection, and it's spread by respiratory secretions, and it enters the respiratory tract. Now, usually we get it when we're fairly young, and it's not something that it can be quite serious with up to 20% mortality if you get your first dose or your first introduction to varicella as an adult. In some cases, it can be reactivated, and this has been seen in people who are immunocompromised, weakened, or also after trauma or surgical stress. And because the varicella is a type of herpes virus, it actually integrates into your the cells, into our cells, and will stay there, basically lurking, and our immune system stops it from coming out. But if our immune system is compromised, then it does seem to be able to come out again, and it comes out in the form of shingles, which can start with mild fever, malaise, and then you can end up with some vesicles, and it can be a very, very painful condition. Now, an astronaut 2 days before spaceflight basically broke out in shingles. Now, astronauts tend to be very, very healthy, and this was a really kind of startling thing to observe. So the senior microbiologist at Johnson Space Center, when he encountered this, it started him thinking, and he thought, wait a second here. This is unusual that we're getting reactivation of viruses, basically, in our astronauts before flight. So he decided to start looking at viruses, and I mean, it's pretty rare that to get shingles, but to look at them almost as a marker of the status, if you like, of the immune system. So he did a longer study, and again, he looked at varicella, and he started looking at it in the saliva that was taken from astronauts, and this would be before, during, and after mission. Now, it's not uncommon or completely impossible to have a little bit of virus present without any signs of disease. It just comes out a little bit, your body gets upset, puts it back down again, and there's no disease and there's no problem. Now, before flight, there was one astronaut who had the varicella DNA that was located in the saliva. But during the flight, and with the saliva samples they took, they found the DNA from varicella in most of the astronauts. And after flight, they detected it in all of them. Now, when they looked at their controls, which were basically astronauts who were not flying at the time, they didn't find any of the DNA. Now, they did also find at the same time, they found a 2 to 3-fold increase in the anti-varicella antibodies over the control group. Now, this is over the control group, though. Now, they didn't have all the samples. They couldn't do sort of internal controls to see how this compared to the astronauts themselves who were providing the samples. But it is interesting to see this 2 to 3-fold increase because a 4-fold difference has been used as evidence of subclinical reactivation in immunocompromised and immunocompetent individuals. Now, they also looked at another virus, the Epstein-Barr virus. Now, it's another herpes virus. It has been associated with Burkitt's lymphoma, and it can be... It also has been associated with nasopharyngeal carcinoma. It can result in lymphoid proliferation. That's in the worst-case scenario. And in underdeveloped countries, usually 100% of the population tends to be positive for Epstein-Barr virus by the time they're 3. And so it transfers very, very well between people, so it's pretty good at horizontal transfer. In developed countries, you tend to get infection much later, and you get maybe 20% of the population ends up never being infected. Now, the primary infection with Epstein-Barr occurs in the throat, and it's usually epithelial cells that tend to be the producers of virus. By the time you get to something like Burkitt lymphoma, you tend to get very little, if any, virus produced. But in that primary infection, you tend to get, if it's in the throat, you can get some significant viral production and also a bit in some of the B lymphocytes. So now, because it's being expressed in your cells, you usually get some... Yes, and it's also highly infectious at this point, and that'll be through droplets or through saliva, and hence the kissing disease, I guess. And also at this time, you're having this viral expression in your cells, so usually your host defenses, including your cytotoxic T cells, can usually wipe it up, take care of it, and you've had maybe a bit of a sore throat and some exhaustion, but you're better. When they looked in, this is the next slide, looking at Epstein-Barr virus reactivation, they noticed that in one study that they looked at a series of astronauts before and after spaceflight, that they saw that before flight they were actually seeing some reactivation of the Epstein-Barr virus. And post-spaceflight, they actually found fairly significant increases in the titer to an Epstein-Barr virus antigen that's actually associated with lytic infection, which means that the virus is actually not just expressed and coming out a little bit, but it's actually being expressed. So they found that this reactivation occurred in around 35% of male astronauts and around 60% of the female astronauts they looked at. This is, again, a small group. And they compared this 35%, 60% to around 11% reactivation in a non-astronaut healthy population that they sampled at the same time. So again, we're seeing that we know that reactivation is basically stalled by a healthy immune system. Now, the immune system is still healthy enough to stop any secondary nasty infections from these viruses or nasty disease syndromes from the virus, but it's not completely sound enough to stop it from being produced at all. And before flight, we're already seeing this. So this is usually being linked to perhaps some sort of stress effect. Now, on the next slide, I've talked about some other aspects of infection or contamination that can be of concern. So I already mentioned earlier about on the Mir space session that they actually reported equipment failure due to mold. And this other part I just thought was such an interesting thing that in one of the modules aboard Mir, they removed the panel from a wall and they found a free-floating condensate. Well, what that translates into is a big water bubble that was floating around behind this panel. And they sampled this. They kept this bubble just basically floating around, and they sampled it, and they were finding, on the next slide I actually get into this, they were finding all kinds of things. They were finding bacteria, fungi, amoeba. They found dust mites. They found spirochetes into this thing. So in some ways, this condensate was acting almost like a sponge, because picking up anything that was sort of floating around at any time. But what was interesting was that this huge number of bacteria and all these things that they found in there was, it was much greater than what they found when they were doing individual like air samples, water samples, and surface samples. Now, before they launch, they actually take an awful lot of samples from the spaceship itself and also from the astronauts, and they were finding things in this condensate that they weren't finding in any of these other samplings. They were saying, well, where did this come from? And maybe some of our pre-launch sampling techniques aren't really up to snuff. So at this point, I think that I've gone through some of the realities, which, yes, there are bacteria up there. There has been a few incidents where there has been some infectious disease, but it has been fairly limited. When it has been serious, it's usually in fairly particular circumstances. But for the most part, we basically have a healthy astronauts in a fairly difficult environment. Now, in the next slide, I start looking at why would this be? What are we doing now to keep these guys healthy? So this is looking at the remedies. Well, in Apollo 14, after Apollo 14, they instituted a health stabilization program. Now, basically, they were trying to minimize or eliminate any health change in the crew just before launch and keep them fairly stable. And this is partly because they had found, before this health stabilization, they were looking at around 50% of the prime crew was falling ill at some point before mission, during mission, or after mission. And they were still fairly... not terribly serious, maybe a bit of a cold, a bit of a skin rash, but he didn't want to take any risks. So what they started doing was they started controlling and reducing the location's contacts before flight, making sure that if anybody was sick, he didn't get near an astronaut. And they tried to start limiting and making sure that they, say, didn't go to any place that might have any, any disease outbreaks or anything. And they also involved a lot of educating the astronauts and the ground crew to basic health awareness, and just to sort of help them to maintain their own health, as far as an infectious disease goes before flight. Now, on the next slide, along with the health stabilization program, there have been some modifications to it. They actually are able to have post-flight quarantine. So if anybody comes back looking a bit ill, they will actually take him away and keep him isolated so that he's not further exposed to other infectious agents and so that he can be treated in peace. And so this quarantine has been used, I think, only once or twice in some of the very, very early space flights, but it's always there as a tool that can be used. They've also done some sleep shifting programs to adjust the astronauts, to adjust the circadian rhythms that they might experience when they're in the space environment. Now, the Russians, as I mentioned earlier, have actually used probiotics to help their cosmonauts with some of the stomach problems that they've experienced. Now, some of the microbiological activities, they tend to sort of check, they do viral serology, usually about 90 days before launch on the astronauts. They usually will do a lot of sampling of them around 30 days before, 2 days before, just to make sure that they don't seem to have any infection. They're also, their health is monitored quite closely. And they're also checking the water that is being brought up to station or in shuttles. And they're also doing analysis of food and just even whatever vehicle is going through orbit or whatever space vessel. They tend to monitor that 30 days before launch and even 2 days before launch, just to make sure that it's pretty clean. Now, one of the problems, though, is that the microbial monitoring that we're doing, it's basically, it hasn't changed in, I don't know, 40 years. We're still swabbing surfaces and trying to see what grows. Well, sometimes, again, if we look at that condensate that had this great combination of organisms that we didn't see in the individual testing, it seems that we're not getting necessarily the full picture. And we want to know really what's going up there just to make sure, again, to be better prepared. Also, there's a lot of disinfection that is being done on station, and so they're keeping everything clean. There's a lot of air and water filtration. The food is monitored. And also the astronauts in their med kits, they do have antibiotics just in case. Next slide talks about some of the things that we're looking for in the future. We're hoping to find better monitoring, basically, of microbial health and just the microorganisms. We'd like to have improved sampling techniques that can give us a better profile of what is the flora associated with either a spaceship or even an individual. We'd also like to see onboard diagnostics. It's really difficult to get samples back, but I think that, well, I'm sure that many of the clinicians who are listening in are also dreaming of a time when you could just say blow into something and something spits out what's causing that nasty cough. Well, that would be a great boon for our use in space. We also want improved microbial control. Now, this would include more resistant or antimicrobial materials. And we also want to ensure that when the engineers are designing their ships, and particularly any advanced life support system, that they think about ensuring that there's no place where molds are going to grow. There's no still water. There can actually be a lot of design that will basically reduce chances of infectious disease. And also, I've included the systematic design of probiotics because that's an area that I'm particularly interested in. So in order to, I believe, to really use probiotics in a practical way, we have to have, I think they might have to be actually custom-made for the microgravity or the space environment. Some other things to consider is that now we've just received this paper that tells us that they're basically malnourished in space because they're not eating. We have to look at ways to improve their nutrition. And I don't know if they'd like pizza in space, but that would probably be a nice change. And we have to learn more about, as I said, the changes that we're seeing in microorganisms in space. We see changes, but we don't know if they're consistent. We get one report here, one organism there. What can we say that can be clear? And the changes that we see in humans, they're also quite across the spectrum. We know that some people handle stress differently, and we know some people aren't stressed out at all. They said that, I've heard the story that John Glenn, while waiting on the launch pad because his flight basically had been delayed, he actually fell asleep. This doesn't seem like someone who's terribly stressed. Now, on the next slide, we're also looking at ways to mitigate the immune effects. That'd be through probiotics, nutraceuticals, and there's been some reports now where they've started looking at some of our space analogs that we use here on Earth, like dietary nucleotides. And the other thing, and this picture is from the U.S. Navy, so I guess they skateboard to relax, is we can also look at ways to mitigate stress and help the astronauts better cope with that. Okay, so my conclusion slide, I basically have sort of said, to date, infectious disease has not been a great risk or obstacle to human spaceflight. We do see that there could be risks, and we see how it should be facilitated, but we're not seeing this. We're seeing, for the most part, very healthy astronauts doing very, very well in what can be a difficult environment. However, our concern is always that with increasing mission duration, that perhaps infectious disease could start to become a significant element. And my final slide, basically I'd just like to say that, I think I missed one here. Okay, so better prevention, countermeasure, here's a scientist. We have to know more about human infectious disease interactions. We have to know more about how humans respond to the space environment. We have to know more about how microbes and materials interact so we can ensure that mold isn't going to grow anywhere up in any space environment. We have to look at microbial responses to space. microbial plant interactions, human plant interactions. And finally, I think that knowing about this is going to be critical to any long duration exploration of space. So that's all I have to say.
Well, thank you very much, Nicole, for an excellent presentation. And may I say, I meant to mention this in my opening comments, your PowerPoint slides are probably among the most attractive that we've ever had. They're just beautiful.
Yes, it's space. How can you lose? Look what I've got as a subject, I think. Thank you.
I mentioned in my promo to this a couple teleclasses ago that one of the questions I really wanted to ask is what happens when you sneeze in a space helmet?
Well, this I remembered that just this morning, and so I went to talk to the scientist who's involved with exploration. And he gave me a withering look, I might add, and said that astronauts don't sneeze in their helmets. And so they have basically filters that reduce any particulate matter that could induce a sneeze. And also, if you have an upper respiratory tract infection, or if you're blocked up at all, then you're not going to do a spacewalk. So you want to make sure you're in pretty top health. However, I'd like to say, though, that I know our flight surgeon, he was going to tell me some really great story about, I think it might have been about sneezing, so I'll have to get back to you on that one just in case that's what he was going to do, but he got called off to a meeting.
Okay, well, if it's a good story, I'd be happy to share it with everyone else later on.
Okay.
Secondly, you mentioned about disinfection, and I was wondering what mechanisms or processes are used to clean or disinfect a spacecraft once it returns to Earth. Is there a special care that's necessary, or will just any process or any chemical do?
I believe, well, on the space station, they actually use wipes, and I believe it's some sort of sulfur compound that they use to clean on station. And when they come back, they do a lot of, I once met them, one of the microbiologists who's basically, one of his jobs was basically sampling satellites before they go into space, and also sometimes some stuff when it comes back. So they do sample, and that's how they found that, the strep mitis on the camera. But I think that basically you're looking at the same things we use here on Earth.
Very good.
Not much difference.
Thank you all for joining us on this teleclass today, and a special thank you to Dr. Nicole Buckley for a wonderful presentation. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Until we meet again, everyone, keep your feet on the ground. Goodbye.